This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening.
Hello everyone, how you doing? This is Ben, you're listening to episode 98 of my podcast, A Small Voice Conversation with Photographers. Many thanks as always for joining me, welcome along. My chat this week is with Matthew Finn, a Northern English voice at last on A Small Voice, and not before time, some of you will be thinking. Listen, sorry about my voice, I'm sick as a pike to be honest. I'm not even going to do the usual spiel before I introduce Matthew. Leave a review, Squarespace, blah blah blah, all that. There will, however, be the following brief messages from my lovely sponsors, namely the Charcoal Book Club and Finder. So the Charcoal Book Club is the world's first Book of the Month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. And every month, Charcoal Book Club works with the most respected photographers and publishers in the industry to send you hand-picked books directly to your door. So whether you are a professional artist or a photographer with a fully stocked library, or a novice who's just beginning to build their collection, the Charcoal Book Club is an easy and affordable way to stay up to date with the most essential work in contemporary photography. They offer free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles, members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more. So for the latest and greatest photo books delivered to your door with free shipping and no hassles, check out thecharcoalbookclub.com, where they are on a mission to inform the mind and inspire the soul. Still enjoying my copy of Liberty Theatre by Rosalind Fox Solomon. This episode is also sponsored by Finder.me, that's F-I-N-D-R.me. Finder is a two-sided marketplace for imaging professionals, providing clients with direct access to thousands of experienced photographers on a single platform, and in turn introducing photographers to hundreds of potential clients. Finder connects photographers with relevant customers based on location and type of photography services offered. Photographers can sign up quickly and easily and for free for corporate contracts at fixed rates, or they can set their own pricing to attract direct clients. And as I had mentioned before, in stark contrast to some of their bigger competitors, the people at Finder have a lot of integrity. They genuinely care about you as a photographer. They won't try and steal your copyright or exploit the fact that, you know, times are tough, and they're dedicated to total transparency in the way they conduct their business. They're for everyone involved in the photography business, from wedding planners to artists. And if you are a photographer, go and open an account, start your profile. You don't have to fill it all in at once. If you want to open up a whole new way of finding new work, finding new clients and finding new opportunities, visit finder.me, F-I-N-D-R.me. Join up, create a profile, get found. So Matthew Finn has a degree in photography from Derby University and an MA in photographic studies from Westminster University. He's best known for his long-term projects, undertaken over a period of nearly 30 years, focusing both on his mother, Jean, and his uncle, Jean's brother, Des. A book of the former work entitled Mother was published by Darry Lewis in 2017, and the work has been exhibited at various major galleries, including Gerwood Space, London, the Impressions Gallery, Bradford, and Open Eye Gallery, Liverpool. The project won him the Gerwood Photo Works Award in 2015. Matthew's latest book, due to be published by Stanley Barker later this year, is entitled School of Art and features portraits of his students taken while he was a teacher during the mid-90s. We talk about all that and more. What an amazing story Matthew has. But why am I telling you? You can hear it for yourself from the horse's mouth. Here he is, Matthew Finn. Obviously, I want to talk about Mother because that's the project for which people probably know you best, because you made a book of that project. But I guess we should start at the beginning, really. So, where did you grow up? Is it Leeds?
Complex. I grew up in Leeds, but it wasn't until I was a lot older, in my late teens, that I realised I was born in Manchester, and. Because of that, that's kind of laid the foundation to how I approach the project Mother, and how I talk about the project, and how I subsequently have made the images for the last 20 odd years. It's this finding out the reason why I was born in Manchester. Always a difficult one, because being, you know, the War of the Roses, you've got Lancashire and Yorkshire. you know, the idea that I reached a certain age and I was teased that I would never be able to play for Yorkshire cricket, at which point, obviously, that was never going to happen anyway. And things have changed. Even Yorkshire has to allow West Indians and Indians to play cricket. But back in the day, that wasn't the case. You had to be born in Yorkshire to be able to play for them. But the reason I... basically, it was I'd been making the work. I was studying at Derby University, doing a degree in photography with academics like John Blakemore, and it was a really interesting time. And I went home. I never lived with my father, and but that's something I'll talk about a little bit later. And he was very unwell, and my mother was smoking profusely. She smoked these wonderfully long menthol cigarettes, and she was telling me how my father was ill. He had cancer, and he was not going to last very much longer. I made the decision not to want to see my father in hospital, purely because I didn't feel like I would have been able to handle seeing him in such a fragile state. But going to the funeral, not too long after that, again, my mother smoking heavily was saying, I've got something to tell you, and that tomorrow morning you're going to be introduced to all these half-brothers and half-sisters. And it was at that moment I was told that my father was married to five different women at the same time in Leeds. And this was an absolute shock, so I didn't really say anything. I didn't know what to say, and I mean, I was 21 at the time, and I went to the funeral, met all these quite incredible people, and ended up going back to my new half-brother, Stephen's house, where we just went out and got very, very drunk. And then subsequently we started looking at these photo albums, and like all photo albums, there are these similarities within the images, the original school photographs you get taken every year. The images of your mother, your family members are on wonderful days out. And what struck us both, and subsequently the other albums we've seen from various siblings, is that we realised that the constant was my father, our father now, and his car, and these backdrops, the backdrops being these northern kind of stereotypical beauty spots in seaside resorts. And whereas my father, as I said, was a constant, we'd been eradicated, each one of us. So a mother had gone and another mother had been replaced, a son or a daughter had gone and another one had been replaced. It was quite an incredible experience to see this. And it was at that point, from very early 90s, that I made the decision that photography would become this act where not only an act of defiance, but an act of the fact that it would allow me not to have to ask difficult questions for my mother, and also then not to have to receive awkward answers. So I never spoke to my mother about the complexities of her relationship with my father, other than the fact that I found out later from her sister that my mother was the only one who never married my father. So the reason I was born in Manchester in 1971 is that in the north of England, Manchester had the only abortion clinic. And my mother, being a Irish Catholic, went originally to have me aborted, and the brother came over and said, look, we'll deal with it somehow. So I spent a period of time in Manchester before I came over to Leeds. And obviously as a child, as a baby, and then that's where kind of photographically, when I found this out, I said, when I was about 21, it determined the type of images I was going to do. And I was presented with a choice. For me, it was a case of I confronted my mother, and it could have blown up the whole relationship, the family dynamic, or B, I would say nothing. And I said nothing, and I used photography as a means to bring us closer. I was fortunate in the fact that my mother lived with her brother. Her brother never married, so they lived together as a brother and sister for 76 years of their lives. And I was very fortunate in the fact that he became my father figure. So for all the times my father would promise me this at my birthdays, this at Christmas, it would always be my uncle who would end up producing the goods, as my father would invariably not only disappoint me, but he must have been a big disappointment for my mother.
Yeah. So that's just an incredible story. I mean, I don't even know where to start to then kind of unpack some of that. But clearly your development as a photographer is inextricably linked with all this stuff, right?
Absolutely. I mean, my father is almost like the elephant in the room we don't talk about. He's completely absent from our lives. He's absent from the photographs. I never photographed my father, but it's because of him that I continued or started to really make the work in such an obsessive manner that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the kind of root cause of you becoming a photographer, it sounds like to me.
Well, more so in the fact that my father, apart from other things, he was a confidence trickster. So he would be one minute, he would be a car salesman selling cars. Another one, he'd be at a boot sale selling rusty nails in a jam jar. The other thing he was a photographer. And what, like all good salesmen or con artists appreciate is the need to look the part. So my father also was a photographer and he used Leicas. And he conned people in the fact that he could be their photographer and do their weddings and make photographs. And obviously there'd never be any results because there's probably never any filming. But I used to look at these Leicas and then have my nose pressed to windows thinking, why are these cameras so much more expensive than other models? And so even before I even was a photographer, somehow bizarrely through this knowledge of Leicas or knowing that they were so much more expensive, very desirable, so my father even probably got me onto photography.
Yeah. So he sort of he took pictures, but mainly he used that as a kind of scam to convince people that he was somehow a professional or good enough to be paid to do
it. Absolutely, everything was a cover. Yeah. You know, everything was a cover.
So, like, when you were born in 71, was he already married to some of these other women?
Yeah, he was married, as far as I'm aware, he was married to five other women. We used to, when my mother used to take me in the holidays to go and stay with her sisters, as my mother worked, we used to see my father's car all around Leeds, or a car which I thought looked like my father's car. So I remember would often say to my mother, is that Dad's car? And she would go, no, it's just something that's similar. And I didn't think of it as a young boy. It's only after I then visited these houses, after I was visited my new brothers and sisters, that I realised these were the places that my father called home. And these are the women that he was, you know, just leaving.
And none of them knew about any of the others, I presume? Or
everybody knew, including my mother. My mother knew and all the others. So the only person who didn't know, so even my uncles and family members would go playing snooker with my half-brothers and go shopping with my half-sisters. I mean, this was, you know, an Irish community in Leeds, very small, everybody knew everybody, and the only one who knew nothing was me, being the youngest child. I was completely blissfully ignorant until all this exploded with the death of my father.
So the other women who were married to him, they knew that they were, that he was, you know, at the same time married to these other
women. Yes.
They somehow decided that was a kind of acceptable arrangement in some way.
Certainly some, one or two conversations that I had with them, and the language which they used to describe my father, I would say it was very unacceptable.
Right.
Complex. He was a complex man, and he spent time in jail because of his crimes.
When you were a kid?
Yes. But again, I didn't know anything about it because he never lived with us, so it had been masked over. I would have probably been saying, so is Dad coming to Christmas, or where's Dad? And, you know, the fact he may have been away for 6 or 7 months wouldn't have been a massive obstacle for anybody to say against it.
Yeah, so because you were sort of basically estranged from him. Didn't have a relationship with him.
No, not really.
But this thing of kind of, you know, it comes up so often these days, you know, that the impact of not having a father figure around, for a boy especially, is pretty well established to be a potentially devastating factor. But you had your uncle. He was really your... as you say, your kind of replacement father. This was your mum's older brother.
Mm-hmm. I had, you know, as an idyllic upbringing as you can have on a rough council estate in Leeds. But wonderful. No, I didn't miss out on anything. And my uncle then subsequently, you know, as I mentioned, like almost a father figure, very much so. But he also provided for me. He was the one who would, with no, neither him or my mother had any artistic backgrounds, but without asking any questions, would provide me with film, provide me with cameras, paper, built a darkroom for me in their home. Never once over a long period of time did they ask me, will you be able to make a career from this? Will you ever make any money? I was incredibly fortunate, and you know, certainly my uncle was absolutely my patron. I mean, I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, extraordinary, because in a way it was almost like, you know, he was an idyllic father figure, and if you'd had a relationship with your own dad, it might have worked out a lot worse in a way. Because
totally worked. I mean, this was the absolute, you're talking absolutely idyllic. This was having a father figure who never hit you, who never said no, who always had time for you, who always played for you, who always bought you games, and who provided absolutely not only for me but for his younger sister. No, I could not have had a better upbringing.
Do you think he would have liked to have had his own family then? Because clearly he never did.
I think what happened, very close family. I think I became very much his surrogate son. I think he was absolutely fine with that.
Mm. Mm. So the photography started pretty early. You were a teenager?
Yeah, I started photographing women. An old Olympus when I was 16, and got into it quite seriously when I was around about 17.
And so your mum was your first subject, really?
Yeah, first subject, partly shy, and she was there, and the first images, I remember, nothing came out. So then I'd give the film to my mother and the 5x7 imprints, and I'd make my mother go to the shop and ask why these didn't come out, and my mother would relay the information, you've not loaded the film incorrectly, or you've done this wrong. So yeah, so she was incredibly helpful, but I think because of that, she was the first subject.
This was some years before you discovered the big secret, right?
Yeah, I'd been photographing for nearly 5 years, both my mother and her brother. We started in 87.
Okay, so because the other project, of course, is called Uncle, which is the aforementioned Uncle, and I presume you started photographing him pretty early on as well.
Same day. There's a portrait of them both together and individually bathed in sunlight on the front step of this house. We'd bought this. Well, my uncle had paid for the house. We lived in a council estate in Leeds until this moment, and it basically, this was the point where, you know, people couldn't get rehoused. The only way to do it was to burn your house down. We lived in a masonette. There was a family below, burnt their house down, and then the men in spacesuits came, and we found out it was riddled with asbestos, and you know, new neighbours came in. There was drug problems, and my uncle fortunately had shares, which in the company he'd worked with, and he managed to buy a house outright for us. So it was incredible. I was 16 years old. We had central heating. I never had central heating before. We had a garden. Never had a garden before. It was absolute luxury.
So you felt, you probably felt quite blessed.
Very blessed. Very blessed. You know, if I could go to the bathroom and not be freezing. You know, it was a great time.
And it's that thing that you. You know, you photographed what was in front of you. That, you know, your subjects were just the people that you were immediately surrounded by. I'm wondering if you think that there should be more of that going on.
What I will say is it wasn't a conscious decision, you know, to make anything special or anything. It was, as you say, they were there, so it was an easy thing to do, and it was trial and error. So I mean, this was a time when I was trying to understand, one, what I was as a young man, where I wanted to go, and what I wanted to do photographically. So I was understanding light, understanding exposure, and they allowed me to, they gave me their time to, for me to make the mistakes and to figure out what I wanted to do. But, you know, it wasn't until several years later that, you know, with making a large selection of prints was a realization that I had something which was worth continuing with.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, what point did you realize that this was a project that was kind of should be ongoing, really?
It was considerably later. Even though I'd been making the work, even after the death of my father, I knew I wanted to make the work, but it wasn't until the late 90s when my mother was ill and she was in hospital. In those days, you could only visit like half an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening. Because I had a dark room at my parents', I just printed all the time. So it was the first time I just ended up making about 400 fibre-based prints, which would be curling in the living room as the sun hit them. And then, you know, it was at that point I realised, yeah, maybe here there's actually something. And it was never going to be a case of I wouldn't, you know, if I didn't like the work, I would have stopped. I'd been making it too long, and I think it was something about my nature, which is obsessive, to continue things. But it was certainly then there was a realization, there is something that interests me here within the work, even if I wasn't fully aware of what that was.
Yeah. What did you kind of conclude that it was ultimately, though?
I mean, well, at that point, which is different to now. I mean, at that point, it will have been the visuals, much the visuals, the formal aspect of picture making, the quality of light, the ability or the interest to be able to make as many interesting photographs in a singular area, which is something I'm interested in. I mean, also at the same time, I was aware of Nicholas Nixon's Brown Sisters, Nan Goldin's Ballad of Sexual Dependency. And there'd been work like Sally Mann's immediate family. So these are continued lives unfolding within domestic settings just interested me. And partly, I think, because not that theirs aren't different, but there was something chaotic in all of those I mentioned, bar the Brown sisters. So there was something in them which, I guess, responded in the way that I wanted to then find something out about my own family. At this point, I had no interest in showing the work. I certainly wasn't ready. I didn't know anything about outlets. It was just an interest in making photographs.
But at some point, you went and studied photography, didn't you? When did that happen? You did a degree, and then you did also a postgrad.
I did my degree at Derby. In the start of the 90s, and I didn't do my postgrad, which was at Westminster, until the mid-2000s, so I had a period away. I was fortunate enough. Derby was a great experience, and it could have gone either way. I mean, there was no formal teaching. There was no assessment points like there are today. It was a case of, here you go, think of a word, you've got 4 months, go and make some images. And, you know, it was quite obvious people could basically do nothing for 4 months, go in the dark room in the morning, hang the work up in a crit in the afternoon, and the work would be dripping because it not dried in time. And then the crits could last for 3 days. It was, you know, you'd be set, the academics would go, like, go and get a quick coffee, and then we're back. Or in many ways, you know, the academics would say, well, shall we do this in the bar? We can continue this in the bar. So it was a very liberal educational experience. And for a lot of students, it went, you know, it was it could go either way. You either kind of embraced this passion for the subject, or you just ended up hating it. So I think probably 80% of students sold their Leicas and Hasselblads the first day they could after the end of the course.
Really?
For me, it did something different.
So, yeah, so you got quite a lot out of it, clearly. Yeah. But so it wasn't practical course, or it wasn't in any way, you know, geared at sort of teaching you the kind of nuts and bolts stuff. It was more kind of artistically driven.
I don't think anybody came out of Derby and became commercial photographers, or not many. I mean, it was just not geared towards the industry. It was very much geared towards interpretation, and looking at yourself. I mean, a lot of the artists they got in, Nan Goldin came as part of the MA program. I remember Paul Graham there. I mean, my first day there was on the walls in the corridors was a Bill Brandt retrospective with all his vintage prints.
Wow.
I mean, you know, you wouldn't get that today.
Yeah, so you had some top-notch people to at least sort of draw. Were you mentored at all by any of those people, or did you kind of go to them for any kind of mentorship?
Not really, no. I mean, not really in a fortunate position, but what it did enable you to do was to go and have a look at their work, visit their work, and actually think, hang on, this is incredible. This person is doing it. Maybe I can make work which I want to make. And because I wasn't taught or told anything about an industry, for me, just making images for yourself, the pleasure of making photographs, well, that's all there was. I didn't know there was anything really else out there.
Well, that's a kind of very pure experience in a way, because you're not being distracted by, you know, the kind of cold, dead hand of commercial necessity, you know, to kind of corrupt the artistic vision or process.
I must be the only person who's never ever undertaken a commercial job, and I've been making photographs for over 30 years.
Right, so you haven't done that.
Never.
So that's what should be a kind of badge of honour, I think.
It should be, yes, it could be. It's not something I'd encourage young students or young professionals to undertake, because it's obviously it's not a quick fix.
Well, I think we should talk more about that, because it's obviously an important aspect of who you are as a photographer, and I think people will be really interested to hear about that, but maybe we'll save that for a bit later, because at the same time as obviously during this process you're still photographing your mum during the whole time, and what were you concerned about, the problem of repetition, and that you were, at some point you were just sort of endlessly repeating the same images, or was that part of the kind of process for you, part of the appeal almost?
It was definitely the appeal. The appeal and the interest was to actually, how do you make images stand out? It was obvious that, if I took... I was taking the same photograph over and over again over a long period of time, 30 years. So how do you make... So the notion of editing, the notion of choice becomes important. And I was, at this moment, I was interested in formal aspects of photography, picture make, quality of light. And so it was a case of, I'd end up with 100 photographs which looked pretty much identical. And so how do you do it? I mean, there was a certain point where you look at the work and you think it's actually going nowhere. And then at a certain point, which is time, you realise what is interesting is that although the cigarette remains the same, the glass remains the same, the backdrop remains the same, is that the person, they themselves in this image has changed, they themselves have aged. And it's at that point, for me, you realise, well, actually, it's doing something subtly different. And I was also interested in this notion of the backdrop, the fact that they didn't get a new kitchen in the entirety of the time I took the photographs. But it was subtly obviously different in the photographs. And in actuality, it was slowly deteriorating. So the backdrops became a metaphor for aging as much as the person in the subjects. So I would every year photograph the same Christmas tree. And I remember when I started, the Christmas tree was a foot too tall for the house, and the top of it would be bending over by the ceiling. And as each subsequent year, as the tree got balder and balder, because it was a fake tree, to the last images where the tree's obviously been cut in half, and it becomes obviously a metaphor for aging and dying and all those things. So even though I wasn't aware of that in the early images, because you make this work, I didn't know why I was making it. It was only after maybe a length of time, but I realised that everything within the photographs were metaphors for what we were ultimately going to happen to all of us, which is we have a moment and then we leave.
How did your mum's reaction to it sort of change as the years went by, or her reaction to you doing it?
Because I, in many ways, I was a coward. So for many years, I would not show my mother, and I would only show it when she was drinking heavily around Christmas time with her sister, normally about 11 o'clock in the evening.
Was she a boozer generally?
Yeah, they liked to drink. Yeah, absolutely. Big drinking. Yeah, I mean, drinking solved everybody's problems, you know. I mean, it was a case of...
But it wasn't a, like... continuous thing for her. I mean, it was, she wasn't an alcoholic.
No. Well, if you were American, we'd be in trouble. But definitely not. No, it was a social thing. It was, you know, my mum enjoyed a gin and tonic after work when she worked, and a nice and a cigarette, and maybe a couple of Baileys later on. But no, not at all. It's pub culture. You know, they enjoyed pub culture, and I grew up with that, you know, in the days when, you know, you'd be stuck outside with a Coke and a packet of cheese and onion, you know, with your nose pressed to the window, screaming your lungs out, wanting another Coke. And these were also days when you, there was no drink driving. I mean, you know, I remember being, when I was young, I mean, we got stopped at the end of a cricket season. My uncle, you know, probably had 12 pints of Tetleys. Very, very drunk. And we stopped by the police because they were looking for the Ripper. Mm. You know, all they wanted...
The Yorkshire Ripper, yeah.
Yeah, you're looking for the Yorkshire Ripper. Went into the back of the boot and wanted to find, you know, if you didn't have a hammer or anything. I remember we closed the boot and said, okay, sir, drive carefully home. Mm. So, you know, things change.
Yeah. Yeah. So not so much there was no drink driving, there was no penalty.
There was no penalty. I mean, going back to we socially drank, and as I said, you know, drink was the answer to everything, and continued to be with my mother. So, you know, if I'd split up with a girlfriend, oh, we'll go and have a drink, it'll be okay.
Yeah, but she seems quite supportive of your, what she must have, you know, end up thinking, as you said, was a fairly obsessive desire to continue with the project.
This is something I've continued to think about, and I've thought about relatively recently, in the fact that I think it maybe comes down to this, for my mother, there's a sense of, I guess, the fact that she allowed me this time. Maybe it's a penance in the fact that she gave me this her time, because out of guilt in relation to what the perception of what I knew or what she knew or I knew anyway about the father, lack of a father figure. So I have been thinking about that really this is a sense of love. It was about love, and and guilt, maybe in equal measures.
Well, I presume that the fact that, you know, she was honest in telling you that, you know, the brutal truth was that she was gonna get, you know, abort you. Mm. I mean, that surely that must be a minefield of guilt, you know, for any mother, and a complicated situation between the two of you.
Yes, I'm guessing it would be. I never approached it to my mum. I've never talked to my mother, and now it's too late since she passed away. But no, I'm open to having the conversations with strangers and to anybody who may want to listen. But it's not a subject we breached, and I think this act of photographing, this obsessiveness of making photographs all the time in her presence, allowed me to escape asking those questions, or maybe allowed me to not having to feel I wanted to. But I never felt a necessary, absolute need to. And now it's too late, so it's tough if I want to.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Yeah. You realise that with your parents, they're not going to be around forever. And if you've got to have these conversations if at all, sooner or later, if you want them. So ultimately, you did make a book, but that was quite a long time in the, you know, coming, as it were. I mean, clearly it was it after your mum died when that actually became a possibility, or had you been thinking about it for some time before that?
No, I'd been thinking about it, and the book was published whilst my mother was still alive. The book was published in 2017. My mother was alive until she died on Mother's Day, 2018. But because of her illness, my mother had, once her brother died, I mean, ironically, when I first started showing the work seriously, I was in Houston at PhotoFest in Texas, and I got a phone call from my mother saying, look, nothing to worry about, but, you know, your uncle's not very well, he needs a heart bypass, but doctors said it's fine, he'll have another 10 years. So anyway, basically, I came back about a week later, and it was obviously something had gone wrong, and I had to sort out the fact that he wanted to come home to die. So a week later, he was dead, and so I'd been in Photofest showing this work of my mother, of my uncle, and getting a response which was, you know, frankly unexpected. People loved the work. I'd shown it to several publishers, showed it to Dowie Lewis, who said, absolutely, really interested in publishing this. Just, you know, obviously, if you've been working at it a long time, so we're not too worried about time, whenever you think you're ready. So her brother, my uncle, never got to say to him, look, we're going to be able to do this, you know, with your sister. He'd been incredibly proud. And consequently, what I found out was that, you know, my uncle had been so supportive of his sister. He'd been hiding the fact that, you know, my mother was showing signs of early onset dementia. And she really, after the funeral of her brother, she went downhill very quickly. She was diagnosed. She had problems with her eyesight. It was a mess. I mean, you know, I'd phone her up and she'd be in tears. You know, she'd be crying, and I was saying what would be wrong. She didn't know how to work the TV control because her brother had done all those things. So I was finding out I was getting taxis to Heathrow. I was flying up to Leeds, getting a taxi to my mother's to realistically just change the TV channel. Put food in the fridge. I'd go back up 2 weeks later. All the food in the fridge would be rotten. So I was having to go back. And we went through this. She was diagnosed with delirium. She never came out of that, and then was diagnosed with mixed dementia. So even though the book had been out for a period of time, my mother was not in a position to actually even to recognise herself or the fact that the book ever existed, which is something that's, it is a shame, yes.
Yeah. You also, you know, were shooting what has subsequently become known as the School of Art, which was not while you were at college, but while you were teaching at various colleges. How did that all start to come about?
All my work, it's this, what is in front of you becomes your subject. I mean, originally I wanted to be a street photographer, but once I'd left university, it was apparent that no one was going to give me any money to wander the streets for 5 days a week drinking coffee with friends photographing.
Apparently that isn't a thing.
I know, it's a shame. I hope it will happen at some point. I was fortunate. I finished Derby and I got a teaching job at Leeds College of Art and Design. And I just thought, well, you know, I was young, I was 24 years old, I had long hair, I was into heavy metal, I had my Leica around me, I photographed. I couldn't see what the difference was between photographing my mother, her brother, photographing on the street or anything else, and not photographing students. They were material in front of my camera to make work. So I just photographed them in the same obsessive manner I'd done with all my work. The classroom replaced the living room, and the dark room or any, you know, drawing studio replaced the street. So for me, it was these people in front of my camera, in their environment that I was interested in. So I just continued to do that.
And you were sort of, you weren't that much older than them. So in a way, you were sort of, you know, they could relate to you.
I think so. I mean, there were, I didn't know at the time because I was so blinded by just making images, but I mean, quite a few of the staff members were thinking like, hang on a minute, what's actually happening here? Is this appropriate? And you know, this, we're going back 20 odd years, and obviously, you know, if it wasn't appropriate then to make photographs, obviously now it's impossible, you couldn't do it. But I continued making the work. Initially I called it Students. It's now known as School of Art, and will be known forevermore when the book's out. But it was a great time. It was in the 90s, and it was a good time to photograph. It was a good time to be a student, and it was a great time to work in academia. You know, there was a sense of optimism, certainly around the mid 90s. You know, we had the YBAs, we had Saatchi kind of promoting through Sensation at the Royal Academy, all these wonderful artists who are now kind of, some of them are household names. We had New Labour, which at the time was great, obviously maybe less so now. We had all these wonderful kind of Brit bands kind of invading America and doing really well over here. And, you know, this whole notion of cool Britannia. You know, we were all young. We were all kind of making art. We were just in and around. At this point, I'd moved to Watford. I was working at an art school in Watford. I could just take 20 students. You know, 19 would be female, there'd be one lad with a skateboard, and we'd be down at St. John's Wood and looking at young British artists, young German artists, young American artists at the Saatchi Gallery down where he was. And you felt invincible, you felt a great time, and I felt a great camaraderie with the students. And it was a different time. You know, you'd end up dating a student because there wasn't much difference between us. You know, things have changed. Rightly, things have changed.
I guess that would certainly be frowned upon now. And now what you've done is you've kind of reconnected with some of those people. How did that process come about?
Yeah, I mean, the connection. I mean, the power of social media. It's a wonderful thing. And Facebook and various sites. The art school in Ridge Street, School of Art, has its own kind of area within Facebook, and it's allowed hundreds of the ex-students from different time periods to kind of put images on there and show their experiences of what it was to be an art school, or a student there at art school. And it's allowed me to get in touch with many of the students that I originally photographed. I've started re-photographing them. And the initial idea was to actually maybe do a book where it was obviously where they were back in the 90s to where they are now. I've kind of subsequently decided it's just going to be the 90s. I just think there's a sense of nostalgia. There's a real interest in the 90s now, which I think will obviously help the book. And you know, I was thinking about Daniel Meadows' great work, you know, and how we kind of revisited. So for me, although I will continue to make new photographs of the students, this idea of reworking and revisiting for a single book just lost its appeal.
Right, so you're going to stick with just the pictures that you shot at the time.
Yeah, and it's going to be 1 year, 97, so all this idea about the cool Britannia, and we're just going to tie it into what was it like to be an art student at that one moment in time. One of the students has written a beautiful introduction where it's talking, you know, doing mushrooms, you know, I don't know, you know, hot boxing cars and things. I didn't even know what it was about, so I had to, you know, I had to Google these things half the time. But it was important that, you know, the students had an engagement with the project, and the students who I've talked about it are fully behind it. They're really interested in it, and like most people, you know, you like to look at your younger self. You know?
Well, yeah, I think it's a kind of bittersweet experience, isn't it? Because in a way, there is a nostalgia to it, but it's also a kind of depressing as well. To sort of, you know, look back and realise that, you know, there's the amount of time that's elapsed is pretty astonishing, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. There's a sense of nostalgia. I hope the images feel fresh and modern, and that even art students now, can maybe feel something of themselves when they look at these images. But certainly it was such a positive experience for virtually all the students. They do feel, wow, they just reminisce about that.
Maybe there is a sort of timelessness to, you know, seeing people who are at that age and in that environment. Actually, I've got a real massive kind of aversion to nostalgia personally. I've got a real thing with it, which I've probably mentioned before. But everyone looks really adorable and cute and sweet, and you know, there's a sort of innocence to it, which is really appealing, I think.
You know, everyone's beautiful. They're 17 years old. You know, there's a cocksure quality about them. There was a sense of fashion at the time which was individual to them. I mean, some more individual than others. I think that the female students individualise themselves more, whereas the lads would be more off the shelf. Mm. I think they were confident. They had their own issues, absolutely. And when I look back, there were obviously lots of issues which we didn't talk about in those days, which weren't diagnosed. There were obviously confidence issues and various other ailments, which, you know, we now know is, you know, various conditions. But certainly there seemed to be I think there's a tinge of arrogance there, but a well-placed arrogance which and confidence which came through in the optimism of the work. And also, this was a time before mobile phones, before we spent 8 hours on a laptop, where critiques were still valuable, so students would have to produce work there, where they could be told off, where you could say to a student, well, actually, do you know what? You've not done any bloody work. Get out of here. Go make some work. You could actually be honest to students, where now, you know,
can you not do that anymore? Is this a sort of snowflake issue?
Can't do anything anymore.
Are you still teaching?
I'm still teaching. Yeah, I still teach clients, yes. Not students anymore.
But, I mean, has it really got to a point where you're not even allowed to, you know, be critical because they might sort of run off and have a fucking nervous breakdown or something?
Nurturing. There's far more nurturing. And that's me being diplomatic.
We're going to have to gloss over that, I think, because I don't think I've... Yeah, I'm probably not going to be very diplomatic. But, yeah, so when's the book going to... Is it going to be another Darryl Lewis book?
No, it's with Stanley Barker.
Oh, Stanley Barker,
really exciting. And that's going to print next month in February. And then it's going to be held back a couple of months, and the launch at Photo London. Right. So we're very excited about that. The design's done, really, really looks fantastic. I've been working with Rachel and Gregory, and, you know, they've brought some real kind of impetus and fresh ideas to the images, have kind of really modernised it. So although the work is over 20 years old, it looks incredibly fresh. Their ideas, this notion of maybe a kind of a sketchbook, so it coincides with this idea of art school and what it is, what students write on, is really appropriate to the work. The edit's very modern, and it's been great working with them. So very exciting.
Yeah, did you manage to sort of bring any lessons that you learnt from having done a book already to this new book? Because I'm always sort of interested by that question.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, they're very different. One of the nice things working with Dowie is that, you know, I was confident knowing that I was giving over something incredibly personal and obviously a bodywork over such a long period of time to somebody who has got a great track record at making lovely books. And he was also conscious of the fact that the work was so personal, so he wanted to get it right. So I think between us, and you try to do the best book possible. I mean, it was my first book, so you know, I look back at it and I think, well, maybe we could have done this, we could have done that, and I'm sure publishers feel exactly the same. But for that moment in time, it was the best book we could do. It would be different if we were to do a reprint or a reedition of Mother.
And you won the Jerwood Prize. Is that what it's called?
It was Jerwood / Photo Works Awards 2015 when I won.
And that was for the book?
No, that was for the project. And then the idea was what type of work were you going to make? And, you know, you have all these mentors, and I have some amazing mentors. I mean, I remember Skyping Alex off, you know, but I was in Greece at the time. Deeply strange. I remember Skyping Eleanor Carucci. Everybody we had was incredible, incredibly supportive. I mean, I didn't think for a moment when I was Skyping Alec he'd know the work. I just thought he'd be going, yeah, he's agreed to it. But yeah. And he knew the way. He'd been to the website. He knew the work. And I was taken back.
That's great.
By that. So it was a very great. It was a brilliant experience. I mean, what I will say is I didn't put myself in for this awards. I didn't know anything about it until I got a phone call from the director of PhotoWorks. My wife put me in for it without telling me.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, so I knew nothing about it.
Wow, so good move.
Pure serendipity.
Yeah, but can you think of any particular sort of things that any of those mentors kind of, you know, brought to the table that that were useful to you?
Well, I mean, confidence, the fact that I actually felt I belonged, the fact that I was in a position where I could talk to these people. I mean, when you're a younger photographer, you know, you just don't feel you're good enough, that you're not worthy, that you're not in a position to be able to, how do you approach these people? So, you know, it was my way in. It was an opportunity to not only have a voice to be known, that where people can actually Google you and actually your name can come up. You think, wow, that's amazing. But it gave me a confidence, probably the most of me, a confidence to actually say, well, you know, what do you think of this work? And what I didn't realise, oh, I, I didn't realise there were so few. Well, I didn't realise how much people would respond so positively to the work. And then you realise, well, actually, there's not that many bodies of work out there, which I've been over 30 years.
Mm.
You know, there are a few, you know, we can name a few, but not there's not lots.
I mean, do you think this business of just by virtue of a project going on for that long brings this amazing kind of depth to it? Is that something that's going to be a kind of constant for you, or can you imagine not necessarily having to have that aspect to your work?
I know people, I have talked to prominent people and they say, look, we'd love to employ you, but you know, you'd only get 15 minutes. What would on earth would you do? Or another one is, you know, we wouldn't want to interfere with the purity of your work. So I think that's a nice way of saying, well, you're unemployable. I think, you know, you get known for certain things. If I'm known for duration amongst more personal work, I'm happy to I'm happy to continue that. And you know, if it becomes unique through the period of time, then that's fine, you know, rather than an individual. You know, I'm not making work where I'm saying this is a unique image. I'm not in a unique situation. You know, these aren't Kappa's D-Day landings. They're not, you know, they're not spectacular historical moments. These are quiet moments which hopefully we can look at and recognise something within our own backgrounds.
So, like, back to that question of, you know, or that, back to that aforementioned badge of honour that you've never had to, or you've never actually done a commission. Like, what do you do for a living then?
I've been fortunate enough. I've worked in education. I've worked at a variety of
Okay, so you've got the teaching.
Yeah, I've got the teaching. And then I just make work.
Right. So the teaching pays the bills and then you get to make the work you want to make. Right. And you mentioned to me at some point in the past that there was a chance of selling some prints to the Tate.
Yeah, we're looking into that.
Is that still happening?
Hopefully, we're looking into it. People are interested in the work because of its, I mean, authenticity, because of its lack of commercialism. I mean, I think there are very few bodies of work there's just nothing commercial about the work whatsoever. And I think that's what people now are starting to enjoy about the work and find that it's quite unique. Also the fact that I make the prints, and I make the prints as I go along. So there's a lot of historical prints over a 30-year period. I think that adds value. It's not been seen up until recently. You know, I think there's a backstory which I think people are interested in, which adds gravitas. In fact, it's film again. It's analog, adds to it. So we're having conversations. These conversations are ongoing, and obviously it would be amazing for me to be able to get work into, you know, any permanent collection. And I am hopeful that this will happen, obviously sooner than later.
Does it feel like a real honour then? Because it seems like the sort of thing you were talking about, a huge number of prints that they weren't talking about buying 10 or 20, but it was a huge number, which presumably could, you know, would result in a pretty significant amount of dosh for a start, which, you know, one can always do with. But also there's a sort of thing I you know, you might expect to happen to a very established and well-known photographer. So I'm just wondering how you sort of, you know, how you view that.
It's never as much money as I think as anybody thinks. And, you know, it's not really about that. I mean, the fact, you know, you can maybe get the work into certain institutions is massive, certainly massive for someone like myself, and on without having to compromise. I mean, that for me is kind of like what's really lovely, is the fact that I make this work. It's a work I've always wanted to make, and I've not had to kind of think, well, I've had to make a certain type of work to get it in here, or I've had to work with an art director to get it in there. So for me, the fact that it's purely the type of work that I've wanted to do adds so much more value for me. And now the fact that it's been recognised, you know, even in a small way, which potentially could become a big way, is fantastic. And you know, we are working hard for this to happen, and hopefully it will.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. So what are you actually working on now then? Do you have any other ongoing project?
Yeah, I've been. I work on all family members.
Because I read somewhere something about a reference to the fact that your wife had replaced your mother, which I assumed meant that she'd replaced her as a subject.
Yes, replaced as a subject amongst other family members. My son, who's 7, and he's become a visual reference, and he's going to be in two parts. In my mind at the moment, it's going to be a 0 to 9, and I'll photograph him for the first 9 years, and then it'll be like from that point to 18. I think what happens then after you're an adult, then it's a decision I think we can have to decide whether there's that continuation, and that's going back then to like the last photograph that Sally Mann did in the immediate family, which is, you know, the last time Emmett posed nude, but it's the last time that Emmett, her son, gave you know, the validation to the photographer that, hey, I will allow you to photograph me. Now, I make work very different. You know, my son's not naked or anything like that. And it's just, again, it follows a similar path of somebody just going about their business. And hopefully it shows a joyousness in what it is to be a young boy. And hopefully it shows a joyousness of what it is to be a father photographing their son.
So he's all right with it at the moment. I imagine he might start pushing back a little bit in the next couple of years.
Well, he's okay with it at the moment because obviously he's too young to really fully understand. I'm sure he will push back, or like what I found with photographing a lot of the 16, 17 year olds when I started photographing the students at college, is that all the lads in particular just wanted to go into bizarre superhero poses, which used to just wind me up. Partly the reason, you know, I generally documented more female students is that they were, you know, they would handle posing far, far better. At the moment, my son isn't doing the Superman poses, but at some point he'll be a superhero, or maybe new superheroes are footballers. I mean, he's already doing ridiculous Cristiano Ronaldo kind of celebrations, so maybe they're the new superheroes. I don't know.
Yeah, probably. So, like, as a teacher of photography, how do you see, you know, the way that students now are thinking about it, you know, as a discipline in comparison to how you used to at that stage?
I think the trend, from my experiences, it's complex. On one hand, they're very confident. There's almost this sense of entitlement. And maybe it's a preservation thing, in the fact that I feel they can go up to any world-class photographer and start just talking to them as if, like, you know, Alex Hoff, Don McCullen, any of these, you know, major players are just on their same level. And that is wonderful, because there's no way when I was younger or even now would have that mindset where I would feel that comfortable. You know, would always be aware, and I think people of my generation and before are completely aware of their own value, their own position within whatever field they're interested in, where modern students seem to have this absolute ability or a lack of understanding of what the gravitas of the situation is, which I think in the end it has to be just self-preservation, which just allows them to just go banging in, hey, here I am, having that confidence, talking to anybody who's a superstar and actually feeling that, hey, I can be your assistant. In fact, why would I just be your assistant? Surely I'm your equal. And that I find staggering, because it's never backed up by the quality of the work. This is what really kind of interests me. It also infuriates me that, you know, students are coming up to you and saying, wow, look at this. This is unique. This is amazing. Surely, you know. And you're going, well, no, that's just a filter. You just put a filter in front of your lens. It's not amazing. It's not unique in any way. But absolute belief in themselves. And I find that, I don't know where that comes from.
Well, you know, this comes up quite a lot, I think, now, and I'm always reading about this stuff that, you know, that there's the generation of young people who, like you say, there is a sense of entitlement. I mean, that thing of, you know, confidence is a great thing, and like you say, you know, probably our generation, you know, that was definitely something that wasn't there, you know, to any degree, but if it's completely unjustified, then it's fucking delusion.
Well, I think the justification comes from the fact that the fact the photographs are rubbish is irrelevant. They've got 600 people on Instagram who love them. They've got 1,000 followers on Facebook or whatever it is. And I think that's the justification that they kind of think, well, yeah, of course I'm great. Look, I've got people saying
But they
great.
Can't seriously think that they are. Not in their heart of hearts. They can't think that that is somehow enough to therefore that's some kind of demonstrating that they've got
I don't know, you'd have to talk to an 18-year-old, a 21-year-old. I mean, obviously social media comes with its own complexities and real difficult social conditioning, but yeah, I think it must. I mean, I must admit, if I get extra followers on Instagram, I'm feeling pretty good. If I wake up and I've had 5 followers, I'm thinking, hey, I must be doing something right. I mean, I've noticed just even having some work up in the show at the moment at London Art Fair, I've hit an extra 30 followers. There is something strangely kind of empowering about it.
Well, yeah, it's designed that way. I mean, it's designed very much that way by people who really know what they're talking about. You know, I mean, I've been listening to a lot of stuff about this. You know, in a way, it's quite sinister because, they're not... those feelings that you get from, the validation that you get from getting more followers and stuff, it's not an accident. They've designed it that way very specifically.
I think, someone like myself, basically sat with boxes of prints under the bed, did nothing for 20-odd years. Yeah, I'm quite happy to have this cynical validation. I'm quite enjoying it. But then, I'm in my mid-40s. I don't have to worry as much about how I fit in.
But and also, I don't want it to sound like we're just kind of randomly dissing the youngsters, and the millennials and everything. And I'm in awe of the fact that they are so often confident and sort of composed and have a sort of sense of themselves that seems incredible to me at the age that they're at, because I didn't know shit from Shinola when I was that age. I mean, you could barely tie my shoelaces. I didn't know anything about who I was. But the downside to it is if there's really no substance behind it, then it's just,
I think it's different. I mean, to be fair to that, I mean, I've worked with some incredible students who are producing some incredible works, which is backed up by not only a sense of confidence, but the outputs are truly wonderful, and they'll be wonderful in any era. And so I think that's, that's really great. And, I love seeing that. And obviously working in education, you want to see that. You want to be able to say, wow, you've had a great day and I've just seen something really special. And so that does happen. It's just different. They don't hang around with cameras in the same way. We hit on this thing about nostalgia, which maybe isn't good in the fact that, nostalgically I remember we'd all be with a room with cameras, and maybe we were just really sad nerds, the type of people I don't like in photography now. I was probably one of them. And because these kids aren't nerds, they're not hanging around with cameras, I maybe put a bit of a downer on them by kind of saying, well, they're not passionate about photography because, they always haven't got a camera on them. But obviously, they always have a means to make images because they always have the phone with them. So I just think it's, for people who are getting on a bit, that we're the ones who have to change, not them. We have a moment in time. And just because I don't understand what it is to be 21 anymore, that's not a bad thing. In fact, it'd be terrible if I did, for both sides.
Yeah. Well, look, Matt, thanks so much. I really appreciate you chatting. It's been great to hear your story. And good luck with the ongoing stuff. I look forward to seeing the School of Art book when that comes out in the summer. And, despite my aversion to nostalgia, I do love those pictures. I do think that they're great, and I will really enjoy that book. And, fingers crossed on the prints, and all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.